Chapter 51 The Gate of Three Dreams. Geraint watched helplessly through the warded entry as Volney paced around the Hall of Three Moons over and over again. Unlike his unrelenting comrade in arms, Geraint had given up the search. They had inspected every inch of the smooth white structure, hoping for any hint of a place where Geraint might slip through Aethon's ward and escape. He and Volney had come up empty every time they had searched since daybreak. The building's narrow windows defied defenestration, and the warded main entrance was the only opening into or out of the structure. Geraint shook his head as Volney came around for another pass. It was time to get the big-hearted Rugothian to leave him behind. The Shallane and the First Mother needed Jen. They loved him. They relied on him. His escape would give them courage, even if he couldn't be with them.
"Volney," Geraint called. "Come here."
His friend approached, face resolute but eyes showing panic.
"There must be a way."
"It's hopeless, Volney," Geraint said, trying to drill the point home to the determined young man. "My only chance of escape is if Aethon decides to drop the ward or is killed. Since I killed the Ugmerian soldier, Aethon cannot know that Jen is free and his ward now useless. I should have thought about that before I ran the man through. But what's done is done."
"You couldn't have foreseen this," Volney said.
"I could have, but I didn't. Get Jen on that horse and get moving. Now, you need to keep as close to Lady Cairn's party as possible. With just the two of you, you can ride. You've got to leave me here. Go!"
Volney turned away, face fixed in a sad scowl of frustration. Jen lay just a few feet away. While otherwise lethargic, the Shallane's fallen protector had managed to don his socks and boots at some point during the night. Otherwise, he mimicked a corpse in demeanour and movement, and only the weak rise and fall of his chest from drawing breath and the sweat beading on his forehead from a persistent fever offered proof that he yet lived. Volney paced around, hands on his hips, eyes roving everywhere as if searching for a solution in the trees and the sky.
"Volney," Geraint said, tone firm, "there is no decision here. You do not stand before two paths needing to decide which to take. Go, now!
Shut up, Geraint, I'm trying to think."
Geraint shook his head in disgust and wandered back into the Hall of Three Moons. While it was daytime, grey cloud cover prevented the light from possessing any strength. The hall felt like entering a room where someone lies sick and near death, a place where everyone holds their breath and fears to speak loudly for fear of disturbing the afflicted. The wilted blossoms clung to his socks as he walked. He ran his hand through his dark hair, frustration burning off into acceptance. When he had learned of the Ugmerian invasion, he had waking dreams of victory and defeat. He either returned conqueror or died in the midst of some manly charge to rescue a beleaguered company or to break through impenetrable defences. At the very least, he died with his boots on, with a slew of enemies dead at his feet. Now he faced the most helpless, inglorious end he could imagine, starving to death alone and miles from home, in his socks. Pushing these thoughts aside, he tried to formulate some argument that would get Volney on the horse riding north. The appeal to duty had not worked, so he would try to seed a false hope inside his stubborn companion.
"If I can convince Volney that escape is possible given time," Geraint thought, "he may feel more comfortable leaving, even if in his heart he does not believe my words."
As he paced, arranging his thoughts into a persuasive argument, his eye caught Jen's sword lying on the floor, several feet away from where the pontiff had trapped his countryman. Geraint stooped and grabbed it. It was an ordinary weapon, save for its blade, upon which an eagle with spread wings had been engraved on both sides, so faintly that only close inspection would reveal it. The bird's demeanour was fierce, beak open and claws extended. Something about the design tickled Geraint's memory. He walked back to the opening, where Volney still paced around the patio.
"Volney! I found Jen's sword. There is an engraving on it that is familiar, but I can't place it. Here, take a look, and then put it back in Jen's scabbard."
Geraint put the sword on the ground and slid it through the ward.
"When you're done, throw me my boots.
I'm rather tired of pulling blossoms off my socks."
Geraint wasn't sure that Volney heard his last request. He had retrieved the sword, and after examining the blade, Volney's jaw dropped, and he sputtered parts of words before coherency returned.
I cannot believe he has this. It's unfathomable. The First Mother must have... But I'm unworthy to touch it."
Volney dropped the sword as if it had cut him and backed away from it.
"What?"
Geraint yelled loudly enough to break through Volney's stupor. Volney pointed at the sword.
"That is the sword of Uldredin Micmir. No one was supposed to touch it until his return. Oh, if anyone knew Jen had it, the First Mother would be in a great deal of trouble.
Incredible, Jeren said. The First Mother must truly admire Jen to give him such a prestigious gift. Pass it back through so I can get another look at it.
No, Volney objected. You've always nagged me about matters of propriety, and this, my friend, is far and away 10 times as serious a matter as anything you have ever scolded me for.
So what are you going to do? Just let it sit there and rust? At least return it to Jen if you won't give it to me.
This blade does not rust.
That wasn't my point. We just can't leave it sitting there for anyone to pick up.
I've got to think.
Well, Jeren said, while you are thinking, pass my boots through. My water skin would be nice, too. I might as well starve as slowly as possible.
Volney retrieved the boots from the hedge and threw them toward the entrance. As they were passing through the opening, they stopped, as if hitting an invisible wall, bouncing back onto the patio. He tried again with the same result.
One moment, Jeren said, fetching the Augmerian blade he had intended to give to Jen.
He repeated what he had done with Aldredon's blade, but the soldier's sword stopped abruptly, just as the boots had.
I'm sorry, Jeren,
Volney apologized at these failures.
I wish it hadn't.
Volney, you idiot, pass me Aldredon's sword.
What?
Pass me Mikmir's sword.
Volney's eyes widened.
Of course. The blade could do wondrous things in the stories. They say that Aldredon could not be kept from going anywhere he wanted. There was this battle at—
Pass me the sword!
Oh, right, of course.
Volney sent the blade skidding across the stones, and Jeren eagerly grabbed it, standing and holding it before him. He breathed in and walked forward slowly.
Maybe you should get a run at it, Volney suggested.
Jeren ignored him, maintaining a stately pace. As he approached the arched opening, he could feel the sickness coming, but just as he was about to despair, something pushed the discomfort out and away from him, the nauseous stirring in his stomach disappearing. Emboldened, he strode forward, crossing the threshold, to join his friend on the patio.
Amazing! Jeren rejoiced, laughing for joy. Jen had the power to leave this place the whole time and probably never knew it. Get the horse and let's get out of here.
Volney whooped and set off toward the tree where their brown stallion munched on a tuft of grass. Jeren examined Jen while Volney fastened the saddle and saddlebags. Their swordmate was little better than a corpse, breath shallow and face slick with sweat. Jeren shook his head and buckled Aldredon's sword about his own waist. Volney approached with the horse.
I think we should just tie the sword to the horse and— Hey, unbuckle that sword from your hip. You can't use that. You're insulting my entire nation.
Jeren rolled his eyes. Volney, there is propriety and then there is survival. Like my father told me, when the enemy is at the gates, don't put cushions in the catapults.
What is that supposed to mean?
Simply that you use your resources to their best advantage when there is danger about. This sword is the best weapon we have. To not use it under these circumstances would be folly.
All right, Volney said. But I'm the Rugothian, so it would be more appropriate if I carried it, I think.
Jeren shook his head. Volney just didn't get it.
But the sword was given to Jen, who is my countryman, so it is only fitting that I carry it for him, until he is able to take it up again, of course. Besides, and no offence, I am the better swordsman.
Says who?
During the ensuing argument, Jeren and Volney hoisted Jen over the horse, and Jeren kept the sword. They left the deserted city, Jen draped awkwardly over the horse. Jeren was glad to be underway, thankful for a spark of hope after a morning of despair. The sun finally broke through the clouds as they crossed the bridge over Mora Lake.
Eldaloth favours us today,
Jeren said, thankful for the light. Volney nodded in agreement.
I think we'd better make a litter for Jen. He doesn't appear too comfortable. You should try the sword on some branches, Jeren. They say it could cut through armour like, one of several comparisons not springing to mind.
Use this sword to chop at a tree?
Talk about dishonouring Aldredon and your nation, Volney. Here we have the blade that cut down Gorus the Dire, hewed 200 Uyumark necks at Armat, and felled Kudat the Giant. Aldredon lifted it high to gather his armies. With it tapped the shoulders of aspiring knights to elevate them to service, and set it upon his knees while dispensing king's justice to rogues and fiends. Now you'd have me attack a pine tree with it.
I can't believe you would even suggest such a thing.
The Shalane rode, thoughts inward, as the forested terrain around her slid by. The sun had emerged the day after she broke her wrist, and while at first the sunshine inspired a general cheer, Maewyn smothered the good feeling before it could fester into anything hopeful.
They soak the ground the day before, she said. and now they let the sun shine so we will be more visible as we travel." As a consequence, the half-elf led them off the road and into the wild earlier than she had intended. While she did not know where the protection of Elder Lurie Mora faded, she wanted to make the point of their departure from the road as unpredictable as possible. It was now midday, the day after they turned off the road. The woods provided ample cover for them and any enemies that wanted to spy on them. No one talked save under the direst need. The Shalane thought of Jen constantly. Dacen always flickered in and out of her peripheral vision now, and as good a man as he was, she needed Jen's company. She missed his wisdom, his devotion, and his strength, but most of all she found herself longing for his irreverent sense of humour. His carefree smiles and conversation in the canyon had cast all her worries into objects of ridicule that she could manage or dismiss. With him gone, the shadows of her fears stretched long and wide across her heart. "And the biggest of those shadows is cast by Shatan," she thought, smiling wanly at the joke she knew Jen would make of such a statement. Shatan spent his time near Padre Athan, the two frequently leaning close, heads together in some private council. From time to time her husband would look over his shoulder to throw her an odd, pained look. While her mother would not reveal the details of her conversation with Athan outside the building near Elder Lurie Mora, the Padre was obviously deeply offended or troubled by what she said. For her part, Mirel remained as poised and calm as ever. As the Shalane did 20 times a day, she slipped her hand inside her cloak and into the pocket where she kept Jen's Animon, the stone the Milim Eri had given her. Its warmth provided comforting testimony that her protector still lived. Her mother had disclosed to her earlier that day that she thought Jen had very likely escaped, though she would not give her reasons for this hope. Beside her rode Fenna, face cast in an unrelenting scowl. Jeff rode behind his wife as if dragged by a chain, the feather that had once seemed so indomitable now drooping unceremoniously off to the side. Fenner wouldn't look at him, speak to him, or acknowledge the many little kindnesses he extended to her during the day. Of all the caravan, Jeff was the only person the Shalane pitied more than herself. While she knew she should think more kindly of Fenner, the Shalane wanted to slap her every time she bemoaned her forced marriage to Jeff. Jeff doted on her, and before their wedding Fenner had preferred the bard's company over any other, including Jen's, though she would never admit to it. The Shalane considered her former handmaiden's treatment of Jeff as undeservedly punitive, and hoped Fenner would mend her ways before the bard went mad. The Shalane sighed, ducking a low branch as they wound through the thick trunks of tall trees. The forest floor was clear of detritus and rolled gently around small rills. The leaves had just started to turn, edges hinting at yellows and reds to come. The thick canopy of high branches admitted spotty light to pepper the ground, and the Shalane judged the place pleasant enough, though the gloom in her heart stripped her of any enjoyment of the scene. Maewyn, who ran as often as she rode, strode to her side.
"How is your wrist, Lady Cairn?" she asked. "Please call me Shalane, if you will. The wrist is quite fine. I hardly feel it anymore."
"I am surprised," Maewyn returned. "It should have taken far longer to heal.
Perhaps I misjudged the damage done. Perhaps. At least it is one piece of good fortune."
While the quick healing of her wound was unexpected, the Shalane also felt unusually fit. While those around her groaned or slumped with weariness, she awoke each day stronger and more alert than the one before.
"Maewyn?"
the Shalane asked, noticing the half-elf preparing to run ahead.
"Yes, Shalane? Can I ask you a question?"
"Certainly."
"Have you ever heard of someone named Samian?"
Maywin's head snapped around, eyes wide.
"Yes.
Where have you heard this name?"
"Since I've worn the stone necklaces Jen had you give me, I see this man every night. He is in some magnificent cathedral. Jen taught me enough of the old tongue that I know that he is speaking it, but besides exchanging names, we have understood little of each other. It is strange. It is a dream, but it is far too lucid and real to be just something from my own head. What do you know of him?"
Maewyn turned her head away, but the Shalane thought she caught some tender emotion on her face before the half-elf could hide it.
"He was a human leader during the First Mikikian War. He lived among the elves, took one to wife, and had a child by her." "Here, let's try something," the Shalane suggested, removing the necklaces. "Wear them tonight and see if he comes to you when you sleep. Maybe you can figure out what he is saying.
He seems quite urgent about something, and I think he's even said your name a couple of times."
The Shalane expected protest to her offer, but got none, Maywin grabbing the stones and donning them immediately.
"Thank you, Shalane. I will see what I can make of it."
Maywin loped off to the front of the party as a hill steeper than most rose before them. The half-elf led them to the east of it along a small creek that proceeded from a still forest pool. As they stopped to water the horses, the Shalane noticed Aethon saying something to Shatan, who looked at her and then rode to her side. She exhaled roughly. Since leaving Elder Lurimora, the Shalane had counted herself blessed for never finding herself in her husband's company.
"Lady Cairn,"
he greeted her nervously. The Shalane wondered if he had ever had a meaningful conversation with a woman in his life.
"Lord Cairn," she returned politely.
"What were you and Maywin speaking about earlier?"
"Nothing of consequence. She was just checking on the condition of my wrist."
"Oh."
He patted his horse and looked around.
"This is the part where you ask me about my wrist too, you dolt," she thought.
He raised his head and regarded her briefly.
"I shall have the horse put down for throwing you once we return. So, how were you brought up?"
The Shalane almost laughed at the ham-handed question. "Aethon at work."
"Well, I lived mostly confined in my chambers. I was tutored in reading and history by the best available scholars, and every day I was asked to recite the prophecy and listen as a wide variety of churchmen outlined my duty to remind me of the frightful consequences that must occur as a result of any deviation from an absolutely moral life. I only left the chambers or the castle complex to heal people in the city."
"And you?
I imagine your lifestyle and instruction were quite different from mine."
Shatan nodded.
"At first they confined me to Ironkeep, but when I grew older, the churchmen, scholars and warlords had a week-long debate about whether I should be allowed out more often. The churchmen wanted to keep me safe, the warlords wanted me visible, and the scholars were divided. I was so tired of being cooped up by that time that I informed them I would leave when I pleased, and the argument ended. The churchmen tried to force me to recite the prophecy every day as well, but I refused one day. The prelate, Coriander, I believe, was so angry with me. Oh, at first he tried gentle entreaties to get me to recite it, then humour, and finally a stern lecture. When I still refused, he grew enraged and started yelling at me and threatening me with all manner of ridiculous punishments. After I had him killed for his disrespect, the church seemed more willing to let me set my own direction."
"How old were you then?" the Shalane pressed, horrified.
13.
"And at 13 they let you dispense with such justice?"
"Yes. All my tutors felt I should learn to act independently as soon as possible."
"And how old were you when you took your first concubine?"
15.
"And who was the first?"
"I don't remember. The 5 principal warlords of Orgmir gifted me their eldest daughters on my birthday, so I received 5 at once. Such a gifting of women is not unusual for a Shadan, or for one who will likely win that position."
"I see," the Shalane said as calmly as she could. "But normally such a gifting would occur after the first wife is taken, correct?"
"Yes."
"So was the church furious at your break from tradition? They reject the practice of wives and concubines."
"Honestly," Shatan returned, "I didn't hear one word about it. I suppose one might call it the Coriander effect."
He laughed loudly enough to draw attention to himself.
"No, the warlords taught me early that the church would try to convert me from Orgmerian into something more palatable to other nations. I, of course, thwarted such efforts as quickly as possible. After all, Eldaloth had me born Orgmerian for a reason."
To the Shalane's relief, Maywin signalled them forward. As if reading from a script, Shatan bid her farewell.
"Thank you, Lady Cairn. It was a pleasure talking to you. I hope it will be oft repeated."
The Shalane inclined her head as he rode off to where Aethon awaited him. While the conversation helped her understand him better, his last statement raised questions within her. Why did Eldaloth have the Har-Ulrich-born Orgmerian? Was it a matter of blood or chance? From where she stood, there wasn't any reasoning in it at all. When the church had first announced that the Har-Ulrich was Orgmerian, neither Tolnor nor Rugoth took it well. The people solaced themselves, however, by convincing themselves that an Orgmerian Har-Ulrich would be a mighty man of war, just what was needed to counter Mikkik's forthcoming assault. Even better, his father was the most renowned fighter and warrior of their age.
Her conversation with Jen about the uncertainty of prophecy now rang more true to her than ever. Doom came to the world before she had ever seen or known Shirtan or Jen. Shirtan was selfish and weak, and she desperately loved the man whose destiny it was to destroy her. The only thing she could think to bitterly laugh at amid the rack of prophecy was that she imagined Mikik would be just as confused as anyone when he won the coming war without the Ilk's help, and practically without trying. All Mikik need do now to recapture Kihal was show up. The Shalane wiped away tears she didn't realize she was crying. How did it all go so wrong? Maywen led them northeast along a slender stream, couched in a small depression, brimming with ferns and low leafy plants with small white flowers. The soft gurgling of the water calmed the Shalane's nerves. Gradually, the density of the trees lessened and their size increased. Maywen mounted her horse and led the group forward at a brisk pace through the easy terrain. As daylight faded, they encountered a path of paved stones that forked beneath two towering oak trees, spreading toward each other to form a natural arch. One fork disappeared south into the forest from which they now emerged, the other veering southeast. The path appeared to stretch north and south as a single road in an empty plain until it bifurcated where they stood. Maywen called for a dismount. As there were no tents, few provisions, and no fire, situating their camp required nothing more than caring for the horses and finding somewhere devoid of roots and rocks to lie down. The Shalane fished a hard roll from her saddlebags after checking the anemone again. Fenna approached and threw herself down grumpily at her side. The Shalane steeled herself for another dose of Fenna's self-pity, but thankfully the young woman seemed content to smoulder while gnawing on a particularly tough morsel of dried meat. Jeff approached, his book, quill and ink in hand. Fenna turned away, evincing a hurt look from her husband. He controlled his face and strode by them without a word to seek out Maywen, who managed to not appear more annoyed and concerned than usual.
"Maywen," Jeff entreated her, "may I beg you to tell us more about this place? For the record?"
Maywen regarded him coldly. The Shalane quickly stood, Dacen following her as she came to Jeff's side.
"I, too, am curious," the Shalane added. "The trees are so beautiful and the breeze so pleasant that this place must have been something out of the common way."
At the Shalane's request, Maywen acquiesced, Jeff flopping open his book and thrusting his quill into the ink bottle.
"We camp beneath the Gate of Three Dreams, for it was said that no matter what path was chosen from here, there awaited a delight in beauty that would linger forever in the dreams of the traveller. The path to the southeast joins the southern fork of the Dunnock River, where scented trees line the bank of the wide, clear river. There moose drink the cool water and bear feed on silver fish that leap from the depths. The path to the south plunges into the heart of the Muleel Forest, where giant firs thrust into the sky with such height and with branches bristling so thick with plump needles that they cast the wanderer into an eternal evening at noonday. Feathered ferns and wide-leaved water plants wet the boots and cloaks of those that pass with dew that continually falls to soft, damp earth. Our road lies northward. Here the path runs out into an open plain of waving green grass, where once mighty herds of elk and deer ran with abandon, hooves striking up a thunder in the air. Low clouds thread through the jagged peaks of the far-reach mountains to the west, falling as they pass under the fire of the sunset sky to cover the land in a soft haze that thickens in the night into a blanket of fog.
Maywen turned to peer into the north, where the haze gathered.
I can only hope that some of those herds remain. We need food.
The half-elf turned toward the practical broke the spell created by her descriptions, Jeff scribbling with inhuman speed across the pages to capture her words.
I long to venture these paths again, Maywen continued, and if you should mourn anything, it is that you will tread only one way, and likely never see the others.
Marvellous, Maywen,
Jeff complimented her, face happy for the first time since his forced marriage.
I think your eloquent descriptions will inspire caravan loads of people to journey here after the unification.
Maywen frowned.
Then please strike what I said from your record. Such a crowd would surely ruin the place.
She stalked off to scout around before darkness and mist obscured her view completely.
I don't think she'll ever like me again,
Jeff said glumly, after closing his book and arranging his other implements within his cloak.
Maywen or Fenna?
The Shalane inquired softly.
Fenna.
Give her time, Jeff. She was very fond of you before the unfortunate events on the wedding night. Fenner is stubborn and can be petulant when hurt. Be patient. The storm will blow itself out.
Thank you, Shalane. I know it is hard for her losing a man such as Jen. If she loved him, then loving me will not be easy. Jen and I are as different as a peacock and a falcon.
True, the Shalane agreed, but honestly, I believe she is better suited to you than him.
Do you mean it?
I do, and I know her as well as any.
Your words bring me comfort, Jeff said, but I wish I could do something to speed the storm's passing. Every day I live with her scorn is a day boiling in agony.
Well, the Shalane said, squeezing his arm as she turned to go. You are a bard, and if sweet words and sincere ones are a way to a woman's heart, then you are eminently qualified to negotiate the trail, however thorny it may be at the moment.
Fenner looked away quickly as the Shalane returned. A chill washed over the party as breezes blown in from the plain to the north pushed them deeper into their cloaks. Fenner's eyes flashed angrily as the Shalane reclined on her bedroll.
How can you speak with him? She whispered angrily, trying to keep Dacen from overhearing. Why shouldn't I? Has he done something wrong?
Fenner folded her arms.
An honourable man would have died rather than accept a forced marriage to a woman who doesn't love him. If Jen and Jeff's places were reversed, I would not be married now.
The Shalane shook her head.
No, you seem to forget that Jen's life was in the balance. Think, Fenner, by marrying you, Jeff was attempting to save an honourable man, and however you feel about him, his feelings for you are obvious. Why should he die when his life could secure so much good, even amid woe?
Well, I thought you at least would understand what it is like to be forced to marry someone you don't love. But I suppose there is one difference between us. You have never really loved anyone else. Your heart has never been uprooted from where it was content and joyful, and asked to thrive in a cold foreign country. When you have felt an attachment as I have, then maybe you will understand what it is like to have it torn away.
The Shalane could bear no more. Choking back 100 explanations and chastisements, Fenner had no power to understand or profit from. Without a word she rose, strolling slowly around the trees until those majestic views which were said to inspire dreams faded into fog and shadow.